Good afternoon, and I forgot to do my disclosure, but I have none. So my job this afternoon, to some extent, is actually to now take what you've heard from the panel and put it in sort of a bigger picture. And I'm going to do some of that focused on the United States and some of it focused more globally, and raise a few thoughts about how might we begin to better address these issues of health inequality, social determinants of health, and in the context of infectious diseases. So Dr. Kumar had shown you this model that we have developed initially and continue to sort of nurture over time that looks at social position, distal causes of disparities in an influenza pandemic, proximal causes of disparity, and then the impact of these on differential exposure, transmission, susceptibility, severity, and ultimately on unequal levels of illness and death. So I'm going to now just unpack this social position a bit more and include some things that we haven't yet talked much about. So the social position in context, and we've talked about poor housing, we've talked about crowding, we've talked about poverty so far, we've talked a little bit about race and ethnicity. We have not talked so much about the poor healthcare infrastructure and adequate public health infrastructure. And I call your attention to thinking about what we saw in the three West African countries most affected by Ebola, where the infrastructures there were just overwhelmed by the need. But also the impact of marginalization, that those populations that may be poor, may be ethnically different in their country or in their community, also may have experiences of discrimination, marginalization, that will affect their access to care. But there are some other things that I think we're seeing more and more globally, and I suspect some domestically as well, that contribute to social position and those social determinants, or exacerbate them as they currently exist. And one is civil disruption, so war, and the aftermath of war and civil strife. That often then contributes to distrust of government. If you have been on the losing side in a country and another group has taken power, so that civil strife can be over, but the impact remains. We're seeing for certain the impact of migration and that the potential for that to exacerbate infectious diseases and existing social determinants of health. And finally, natural disasters. And we saw in Haiti, what happened after the earthquake in Haiti? The introduction of cholera in Haiti from actually those there to provide part of the relief infrastructure. And I wanted to share with you, you know, in influenza in particularly, you know, we often think about where those populations, where those outbreaks first occur and those strains are first detected are often in countries, particularly in Southeast Asia, where we have people who are working in live poultry and animal markets with close exposures to those animal vectors. They are often living above poultry and in crowded situations. So this is one of my photographs from Laos in a village on the Mekong River, where, and what I don't have is a great photograph of the other part of what I saw was pigs, ducks, chickens, and people all living basically in villages where the people are just above, spend part of their day below, and then they sleep above. And then the social determinants involved, and we saw this in H1N1 in Egypt, where a marginalized community who were garbage collectors, and the culling of the animals they used for that. So they were marginalized, that contribute to their vulnerability to culling, and then therefore making them more poor and more vulnerable. But how did this play out in 2009 during the H1N1 pandemic? So I want to share a little work. Dr. Kumar was part of the team that led this. And so again, we go back to the model. And now how did we measure some of these in 2009? We did two rounds of data collection. We collected data in a national representative sample in June of 2009, soon after the pandemic was declared, and then again in late January, early February of 2010. And we were saying, okay, how might we measure some of these potential disparities? So we had structural measures that each respondent answered that got at crowding issues of social mixing and exposure. We also asked about, remember, we were asking people to work at home, social distance. So we really said, does everyone have the same capacity to social distance as some of us in this room may have? So we asked a number of items about their ability to either work outside their workplace or to get paid if they were not in their workplace. We also asked about exposure, and we looked at other measures of social distance. Could they have daycare for their children apart from a group? Could they avoid public transportation? We looked at self-reported chronic diseases as measures of susceptibility. And we looked at access to care. Did they have access to a healthcare provider, health insurance? Did they believe that lack of insurance or money would make it difficult for them to get the flu vaccine? And then finally, had they ever experienced discrimination or hassle when they were seeking healthcare? And I'm going to give you just a quick kind of summary here of some of the disparities in exposure where geographic and living situation placed African-Americans, Spanish-speaking Hispanics, and English-speaking Hispanics at greater risk. But for larger household size and inability to work-related inability to social distance, it was those people who were Spanish-speaking. And what I mean by that, they chose to take the survey. They had a choice. They could take it in English or Spanish. They chose Spanish. That for Spanish-speaking Hispanics and African-Americans, difficulty having their children cared for aside from a group of children. But for all three of these groups, they had difficulty avoiding public transportation. So placing them at higher risk for exposure now. The issues of prevalence of chronic disease, African-Americans were only marginally higher, and that was a little bit surprising, in fact, to us. But finally, we saw that there were also difficulties in access and disparities in access. This, especially Spanish-speaking Hispanics, experienced and all reported discrimination. So Dr. Kumar then said, okay, with the second round of data, we had a longitudinal portion of that sample, over 700 people who took the sample in June and then again in January. And what we found was that a higher incidence of influenza-like illness was associated with greater inability to social distance at work and a greater number of children in the home. So it might link to that issue of crowding. And that it was Latinos in particular who were affected by these determinants. So when we started looking at the absence of workplace policies specifically, the ability of people to avoid the workplace when they're sick, we found that it contributed to a population attributable risk of 5 million additional cases in the general population, but 1.2 million among Latinos alone. So these disparities have a significant impact in disease incidence. So what are some of the ways we can begin to address this issue in planning and responding to infectious disease outbreaks? So we've heard a lot about the standard public health surveillance that looks at incidence of disease, case reporting, hospitalizations. But we've talked a lot about, and WHO talks about, a health equity surveillance system. Is there such a thing? There really is not. However, we collect data from a whole array of sources on a routine basis that could help us look at what are some of the issues of inequalities and social determinants that could drive infectious disease. So, healthcare access issues, how many primary care providers are there in these high poverty census tracts? What's the physical environment? What are the issues of density of population, food security? And so from census tract data to a whole array of other health data, we could, in fact, have a sense of where we have vulnerable and at-risk populations. We could also look at those and stratify by social groups within countries and with measures of inequity in health and determinants between these groups. So even within a low-income country, which groups are more vulnerable than other groups? We're not really doing this yet, but could we do this? The other thing we could do that we have not yet done is what role do communities play in helping us understand this broader contextual, these broader contextual variables? And so to what extent can we engage community health workers who have cell phones, text messages everywhere in the world, right? Can we engage them as part of the surveillance process in ways that we have not yet done? But also, because what do they know? If they are community health workers, they know where you have the most at-risk populations. They know a lot of those other social determinants in ways that, you know, those doing the formal surveillance may not understand. I will give you an example from actually a former student of mine who was detailed to Liberia twice. And so she was working with communities, or working with the Ministry of Health when they changed the border openings and started letting people back into the country. And so they were working at the formal border crossings. She started talking to communities. What'd she find? People don't cross at the formal border crossings because it's a hassle. They have long lines, they have a variety of things they have to deal with. So she went to these informal border crossing communities and they said, we'd like to help, we'd like to be involved in this. They all got trained in how to recognize the case and then how to report it and get help. So they had the desire to do it. This was not something the system recognized as a problem, but the communities knew that it would be a problem. The other thing that we often do, especially internationally, is we send out teams that may not have all the skills we need them to have. So, you know, can we further involve health educators? Can we involve anthropologists? Can we involve people who understand GIS and sort of expand the more typical epidemiological teams that we may send out so that we can begin to understand these social vulnerabilities more. So Dr. Kumar and I looked at, when you look at pandemic plans across the world, what you see is virtually no mention of social determinants of health. Occasionally there are words used like cultural competence, vulnerable populations that are rarely defined, or at risk that are often not defined. But social determinants do not get talked about in those pandemic plans, as if pandemics are equal opportunity events. So one of the things that I think is critical is to begin to think about and have the same dialogue we've had about chronic disease and social determinants in planning for pandemics, but also engaging some of these populations and how do we begin to assess the barriers they would have to accessing care, assess some of the social determinants that may be most relevant. We can't solve poverty tomorrow, but what are some of the things that we could learn that we could do? But I think there's one other thing that we have not yet talked about, and that is a potential planning opportunity, is when we know where we have the most at-risk communities, as we begin to think about distribution of vaccine, both from the richer countries and pharmaceuticals to lower income countries, how do we make sure that maybe we can do some rethinking of how we do that? Can we pre-position vaccines in places where a disease might take off because of this social vulnerability and these social determinants and get vaccine to those communities earlier. So a couple of call to actions that we really, as advocates, this is a great size room, so can we really be advocates for recognizing that social determinants of health and inequalities fuel infectious diseases, morbidity, mortality? This is not news, but now I think we have the science behind it in ways we have not had. How do we determine to, how can we better integrate surveillance, health equity, and health inequality and social determinants of health data to improve our planning and our response? And how can we engage some of these communities in ways that build upon their expertise and also perhaps build their capacity for resilience in these outbreaks? So thank you very much. Questions? Yes, ma'am. Actually, what we did is we spent a lot of time thinking about what was happening in the media around that time, which was the speculation that it would be potentially an experimental vaccine, it would be a vaccine that didn't go, that was kind of rushed through the approval process. And so we actually did ask about whether people would be willing to take a drug that had not been through the standard approval process. And what we found was that there were pretty significant racial disparities in that. Spanish-speaking Latinos were more willing, the most willing group, to take such a vaccine. Whites were second, and African Americans had really low rates of willingness to take such a vaccine. So that's going to continue to be a challenge, I think. I know from my current vaccine work, those kinds of disparities. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I just a comment. One thing you may want to consider when you're looking at the international arena for this is, and I'm trying to phrase it nicely, is the corruption index for various countries. Because, for example, recently there was an outbreak of polio and the need for immunization and vaccines was donated in Ukraine, and the government there was, the people were holding it up because they missed a number of issues. So, this can be an issue.
Well, and I think that's where working closely with both local ministry but also with local communities would tell you whether those are factors that are going to come into play in ways that certainly any of us coming from outside would not even begin to understand. And then what are some ways to grapple with it? You're absolutely right. Yes, sir.
So, it's nice to get a conceptual model, ultimately verifying the data, so that's exactly very pleased with that. And then at the same time, the story you gave, these kids beat some parts. It was your student in Liberia who realized that it's the informal border problems, not the ministry, not the government. And so, the kind of vicariousness of that, kind of idiots. So, I don't know if you have an answer, but if the governments in charge are not aware of these kind of informal cultural dynamics, then what else might you add to your corporate action?
Well, I think one of the, I have a question really for all of us to grapple with at some point is, I think that philosophically and scientifically speaking, we all believe this is important for us to do. Politically, economically, what's the feasibility of having, greater attention to social determinants of health in planning and in policy? And I think that's something that, hopefully we'll have a little time to chat about here, because I think that's what you're talking about to some extent. Okay, thank you.
Hi. Yeah.
I was asked to sort of think about a few and make a few comments, but I'd rather ask a few questions than make comments. So one of the questions as I listened to the whole panel and, you know, the importance of work from looking at social networks to poverty to census tracts, a whole array of dynamics that fuel these kinds of inequalities. One of the questions I would have for the panel, and I've got a couple, is given our current situation worldwide, not just domestically, of resource and policy constraints, how do we go about better integrating this into our planning, our practice, our policies, so that we really are addressing some of the things we know to be critical factors in infectious disease outbreaks? It's the $64,000 question.
Yeah, I don't have any magic answers to that. There's sort of concrete things that can be done, and then hopefully just reorienting our thinking over time. We haven't had that much in the way of socials. I mean, certainly from the public health practice sector as local, state, federal government, we've been aware of, but we haven't had that much data on a lot of the social determinants of health. As we get more and get more used to looking at it, I think we can start thinking in terms of how can we integrate this into our often sort of simple ways of responding to problems that initially are simple ways, like it's easy for me to say, gee, poverty and poor neighborhoods are associated with higher severe influenza disease. One easy way to attempt to deal with that is increasing vaccination rates, which is a super challenge, as you've heard, because some of those same communities may be resistant and suspicious of government and suspicious of their simple solutions. Obviously, we can't deal with all the SES factors at once. I've heard some other presentations here where there's been a lot of community, there's been a lot of involvement of community groups, a lot of discussion, a lot of sort of joint planning to figure out how can we understand those of us who are in positions of power, how can we understand the communities that aren't in so much power and involve them in planning and then try to find solutions that actually might work. I think that's something that we have to increasingly do. It's laborious, it involves a lot of time, it's not an easy one-off. Let's just do this, that's all we need to do. It takes a lot of work to do that. Again, at this conference, you see a lot of the results of that and people trying to do that, and I think that's certainly a direction that we have to go in. So that's my first comment.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I should say that from the global health perspective, we're worried here that we don't have enough data on social determinants. There's even less over there. And so I think my worry would be, like Jim, you know, the first go-to in influenza, in dealing with influenza, is vaccination. And in a developing country, people sort of, that's your go-to intervention. And, of course, vaccine is not going to be available most likely in a pandemic. And so really thinking of other interventions that might work and studying and assessing their potential impact becomes important, but then the methods and the tools don't exist in developing countries. And so really taking the training in things like modeling and simulation, but also, you know, just social epidemiology to developing countries, I think becomes very important.
Yes, sir.
United States, and across the world, as a social experiment, I look at the states now at very high levels of Connecticut. By Connecticut, because of the state, Connecticut's now 40% of the children in Connecticut go on Medicaid, 40. And how does that impact vaccination uptake and so forth and so on? Just because you have it, there's community health centers or doctors that have it, doesn't mean people use it, because they have it. February 2010 at an interim meeting with CDC at NASHO in Atlanta on the H1N1. We sat around the room, there was 25 of us, and there were inner-city health departments, which has a vast inactivation of N1s into their populations, like Baltimore. And then there were other ones who said, nobody wants it. Some of the reasons you mentioned before, the year of update. So it was a conspiracy that thought there was nanotechnology embedded in the vaccine. Just something to think about, you know, boots on the ground, delivery.
I think we have we actually have kind of an interesting social experiment in many ways. The expansion of Medicaid in some states, other states failing to expand Medicaid, which could have, even aside, from population attitudes and beliefs, and just a system, impact on the availability of vaccine and care. I want to shift gears for a moment and ask another question, because many of us, or all of us, are at educational institutions. And so I really want to ask the question of how we might, as we think about grappling with social determinants of health and bringing that into the infectious disease arena in a more effective way, what does that mean we have to do with preparing practitioners and preparing researchers? So preparing those that are going to be out in the field and doing this work either at the local, state, globally, but also the researchers that are coming along now. What do they need to be thinking about differently or doing differently in order to be prepared to do this well and effectively? Does she need the mic?
Yeah. I'll just say that, we know that when we're thinking about factors that change dynamically over time, we do a very bad job of predicting the future and knowing what's going to happen. So I think training students in academic institutions to know how to deal with social dynamics may be one important thing coming up in the future. So understanding the methods that are used to deal with dynamic situations, systems thinking, just conceptually, but also mechanistically, how do you deal with the methods that can help you, address complex systems questions might be important.
I can speak to sort of public health practice in a sense. Public health practice, again, has been dominated by relatively simple models. And by public health practice, I really mean at the state and local, federal level, as opposed to NGO level or some of the others that are really trying to deal with problems much more related to the communities, the specific communities, often with many social determinants of health that they deal with. But sort of thinking about it from a governmental perspective, the people who are headed in that direction, headed for leadership in that direction, I think they need to start, part of what needs to happen in public health school, but then what needs to happen within their professional organizations is increasingly have a focus on social determinants, looking at data, collecting data and looking at data using those social determinants. I can just say that, for example, the use of census tract poverty and influenza, which is a relatively, seemingly a very simple thing, nobody has looked at it that way. People just don't look at that data that way, and they have a hard time interpreting it when they see it. I can say that since I've also worked in New York City, that New York City recently took a look at a whole lot of disease outcomes at once using area-based poverty and found a lot of them were associated with it one way, a lot of them the other way, and some of them had no relationship to it at all. But then when they started trying to interpret it, they had a very hard time interpreting it. So just to understand what you add a new piece of data, a new way of looking at things, and people don't know how to look at it. They don't know how to interpret it. And so I think things have to start with, at least at that level, collecting the information in a way that's going to force them to look at it, and or collecting information that forces people to look at problems in a different way. It's sort of to hold up your little ball of a problem, and you can look at it this way, this way, this way, and you need additional ways of looking at it, and then a lot of time discussing it and figuring out, what does this mean? What are the implications for what are the implications for prevention? What are the implications for community planning? And then going from there. And so, something that's happened in public health practice, HIV has been a great model, in a sense, for getting people to think about social determinants a lot more than they had before, but that needs to happen with a lot more problems. I think it's beginning to with some of the chronic disease problems that are being addressed now, as opposed to the infectious disease problems, which often have a vaccine or a treatment associated with the end of them, so people don't get into the complexities as much, but they need to.
Yes, sir.
What I was going to say is that what's not being in the conversation
So we actually are at the end of this session by my watch, so thank you very much for hanging in there to the end with us.